All right, so this is Bio 160, and it's January 27th, and it's Tuesday. Don't forget, there's a test 1 week from today, covering the material at the end of the handouts that I have for you guys. And we were talking about the cell membrane last time, and the basic structure of the cell membrane is what we call the phospholipid bilayer. Because if you look at the structure on the slide right here, you see that there are just two main layers. Here's one layer right here, and then here is the second layer, and they're just sandwiched together. That's a phospholipid bilayer. There's a better way that we can describe the plasma membrane besides just the phospholipid bilayer, and that is there are other substances that are inserted into the membrane, sometimes to stabilize the membrane or to give it other kinds of functions. For instance, here's a protein in the phospholipid bilayer, and this protein right here might actually be a channel, might be a passageway where things can move in or out of the cell which can't move across the phospholipid bilayer. We call that a channel. Sometimes there are proteins that are enzymes that can convert other substances into other kinds of compounds that the cell needs. So these proteins could be enzymes. Also on these proteins, some can be modified with sugar molecules. So each one of these is just a nice simple monosaccharide right here. This is what we would call an antigen, and the shape of these carbohydrates determines what organism this cell belongs to. So every organism will have a different shape carbohydrate right here, and this is what we call antigens. So the antigens in your brothers and sisters are going to have a very similar kind of shape, right? And as you move to people that are less related to you, like your cousins, the shape is going to change a little bit more. And when you go outside your family, then the branching pattern or the shape of these sugar molecules is going to be very, very different. So that your immune cells, when they're looking over everywhere, all the cells of your body, they can tell if this cell belongs to you based on the shape of these antigens that are sticking off the cell membrane. All right, so proteins could be antigens, they could be channels, they could be enzymes, but they can also be receptors. Sometimes these proteins, all right, will bind signaling molecules. Maybe a hormone will come in and bind to this protein right here, and that's going to change some function on the inside of the cell. So receptors are put into the cell membrane as well for communication. So the membrane is actually a pretty sophisticated kind of organelle. It's made up of the phospholipid bilayer, but various other proteins are added to it. So a better description of a plasma membrane is what we call the fluid mosaic model. It's a way of thinking of the plasma membrane. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but it's also a mosaic because all these other proteins can be added to it to give it structural support or ability to catalyze reactions or to communicate with other cells, or to identify the cell as actually being part of your body. All right, that's the fluid mosaic model. So all these proteins add to the mosaic nature of the fluid part, which is the phospholipid bilayer right here. Okay. All right, so what are some organelles that we want to look at? Rough endoplasmic reticulum, smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, I'm just going to find a nice picture of a cell and start to talk about some of these things. And here's that picture. And here, this I'm sure is an exam figure. All right, so make sure that you know the name of all these organelles just by its shape. All right, and of course, please don't memorize the name by the color that's on this diagram, because don't forget, your test is just going to be photocopied in black and white. So you got to know it by the structure, what it looks like. Okay. We're talking about endoplasmic reticulum. All right, here is the plasma membrane. What's the best way to think of the internal structure of the plasma membrane? The simplest description of a plasma membrane is this phospholipid bilayer, right? And all membranes inside the cell have that same nature. They're all phospholipid bilayers. So I see a bunch of membranes over here. Guess how this membrane is put together? With phospholipids in that phospholipid bilayer arrangement. Right, here is an organelle that's surrounded by a membrane, and guess what that membrane is like? It's a phospholipid bilayer. And here's another membrane organelle that's a phospholipid bilayer as well. And there is a membrane that surrounds chromosomes or DNA inside the nucleus. We call this the nuclear envelope, and it is made up of a phospholipid bilayer membrane as well. So organelles inside the cell that have a membrane around them, they're surrounded by that membrane. We call those membrane bound, and all those membranes are the same. Right? They're just that phospholipid bilayer. Other kinds of organelles inside the cell don't have a membrane around them, and a good example would be these two structures right here. These are what we call centrioles. They don't have a membrane around them. They are just made up of microfilaments or microtubules, like little protein sticks, and I'll tell you what those are for in just a little bit. So you got membrane-bound organelles and others that are not bound with a membrane. So let's start with the membrane-bound organelles, the ones that are actually made up of membranes. And we see a system right here of membranes that kind of surrounds the nucleus. And when you have a system of membranes like this, we usually call that endoplasmic reticulum. Endoplasmic means inside the cytoplasm. Reticulum means that it has a lot of branches and folds on it. And this one, you can see, has these dots on it. Can you see those little dots right there? What color are those dots? Anybody see a color? Not much color, huh? Purple? Dark. They're just dark. That's what I see, too. Okay. All right. And these little dots give the surface of this endoplasmic reticulum kind of a rough appearance. Kind of looks like sandpaper. So we call this rough endoplasmic reticulum. And the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is to make up protein. I think that's one of the basic kinds of organic molecules in your body is a protein. And do you know what makes a protein? What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid is a building block of this protein right here. So this membrane system can make proteins because it has these little dots. And those little dots are an organelle all by themselves. These little dots are what we call a ribosome. So I see some here on the endoplasmic reticulum, but I also see some here floating out in the cytoplasm. This is what we call a free ribosome. But nonetheless, the ribosome, the function of a ribosome is to make up protein. So protein synthesis is the function of ribosome. And since the rough endoplasmic reticulum has ribosomes, guess what the function of rough ER is? Is protein synthesis, because it has ribosomes. There's another kind of endoplasmic reticulum that we call smooth endoplasmic reticulum. It doesn't have ribosomes on it. And I see that right here. So because, since it doesn't have ribosomes, can this smooth ER make a protein? And the answer is no, it can't, because it doesn't have the ribosome. But it, nonetheless, it's responsible for making another important molecule, and that is a lipid. It's important for making fats. And did anybody learn an important kind of fat molecule that's used a lot in the cell? Fatty acid is a kind of fat. Cholesterol, for instance, is a good one. But remember, what makes up the plasma membrane? What kind of molecule is that? Phospholipid. That's a kind of lipid molecule. So this smooth endoplasmic reticulum is important because it even makes these phospholipids that make all the membranes that you see right here. So it's got a pretty important job, right? It makes all those membranes because it can make phospholipids. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum can also store calcium inside the cell, calcium ions. And maybe we'll see why calcium is important for cells, but probably you all know that calcium is important in your body. Why is calcium important for your body? For bones. Yeah, it makes you have strong bones. That's one reason, but that's like one of the least important reasons why you need to have good calcium in your body. There are other important reasons that we're going to look at later on in this class. And for those other important reasons, a lot of times it's stored in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so here's another membrane-bound organelle. Notice that endoplasmic reticulum kind of folds around the shape of the nucleus, right? But notice how this organelle, the folds of its membranes kind of go opposite to the shape of the nucleus. Do you see how it's kind of pinching away from the nucleus a little bit? This is what we call a Golgi body. It might be labeled Golgi apparatus right here. So those two names refer to the same organelle, Golgi body, Golgi apparatus. You're going to notice that in this class, maybe you have already, like nucleus has different meanings depending on how it's applied. The nucleus could be the part of the internal part of an atom, but the nucleus is also the internal part of a cell right here. And we'll learn another couple definitions for what nucleus means. So, so a structure can have different names, like Golgi apparatus or Golgi body, or a name can be used for different structures, all depending on the context. Probably a good example of how a particular structure can have different names, like for instance, there's a street right out here that's called Lincoln. But if you don't get off of Lincoln and you drive to Long Beach, all of a sudden you're not on Lincoln Boulevard anymore. What are you on? You're on Carson Street, right? So it's the same street, right? But it has two different names depending on exactly where you are. And as a matter of fact, I have different names too. Like for you guys, I'm Dr. Gober, but there's other people that maybe would call me something else at different times, like Honey, right? Who would call me Honey? You guys wouldn't, but my wife would, right? So different people have different names depending on different circumstances, and you just have to be familiar with those different names, right? So Golgi body, Golgi apparatus, right? And the job of the Golgi apparatus is to take proteins that are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum and modify them, right? Maybe cut them in half, give them some activity, or modify them by adding a sugar molecule onto them. And that's the Golgi apparatus, is for modifying. Take proteins from the rough ER. Okay, take proteins that are, so that's just a strictly protein kind of molecule. It goes into the Golgi apparatus and it's modified, right? So modification is an important function of the Golgi apparatus. And maybe it's modified by adding a sugar molecule to it. That's what we call a mucopolysaccharide. And a lot of times we shorten it up. Instead of saying mucopolysaccharide, we're going to say mucus. And what can you tell me about mucus? Yeah, it's that stuff that runs out of your nose when you have a cold. So it helps fight infection, but it's also important for lubrication and other kinds of functions. It helps adjust pH too a little bit in certain parts of the body. All right, so mucus is made by this Golgi apparatus right here when it modifies a protein. So, and then it packages, for instance, if it's a mucus molecule, you don't want mucus inside the cell, you want mucus outside the cell, like running down your nose or something, right? So that mucus has to get from the Golgi body to the outside. So we can see little vesicles right here pinching off of the Golgi apparatus. And so now here is a vesicle that contains mucus, and it finds its way to the plasma membrane right here, fuses to the plasma membrane, and when that happens, whatever inside this vesicle has a way to get out of the cell. So we would call that exocytosis, right, or secretion. So these could be secretory vesicles leaving the Golgi apparatus, right, to find its way outside the cell. So the job of the Golgi apparatus is twofold. The first part is for modification, and the second one is for packaging, right, into these secretory vesicles for secretion outside the cell. So let's see, what did we say? Smooth ER for lipid synthesis, rough ER for protein synthesis, Golgi apparatus for modification and packaging of proteins.
And packaging.
And packaging, make it, turn that product into some kind of package that can be exported from the cell. Packaging, yeah. All right, how about another one? This guy right here. This is what we call a mitochondria. And you can see that there is an outer membrane to this mitochondria and even an inner membrane to it. So it's a very complicated kind of organelle. And it actually resembles a bacteria, and it has its own DNA, has its own cytoplasm. And what do we call something that has a cell membrane and cytoplasm and its own genetic material? We call that a cell. So this actually is the remains of a bacteria that infected the human cells way back millions of years ago, and a very interesting symbiotic relationship developed between this bacteria that invaded this cell and the life of this cell right here. So what does a symbiosis mean when there's a symbiosis? It requires two organisms. A A symbiosis means when two organisms live together and they're dependent on each other. They give each other things that are necessary for life. And if you remove one of the organisms, then the other one might actually die as a result of that. So a symbiosis requires two organisms living together, and they both perform some kind of beneficial function for each other. Right? And the job of the mitochondria in our cells is to make ATP. And ATP is the energy molecule. So what's the energy molecule in your car that you use?
Yeah.
Gasoline? Yeah, most people have gasoline in their cars. So you can think of mitochondria as the organelle that makes the gasoline that runs our cells. And without gasoline, how far would your car go? It wouldn't go anywhere. How far would a cell go without ATP? It wouldn't go anywhere either. It would die as a result. Huh? It couldn't even live, yeah. So a cell would die without ATP. And cells get ATP from these mitochondria, right? So that's half of the symbiosis. But what does this mitochondria get out of the deal for living inside this cell right here? A symbiosis means that the benefit has to go both ways. All right? In order for a mitochondria to make ATP and for it to stay alive, it needs oxygen. So how does this mitochondria get oxygen? Because we're breathing in oxygen into our bodies all the time. So mitochondria get oxygen because of our bodies, but the mitochondria get something else too. If this mitochondria were just living on the tabletop over here, then it could be eaten by other bacteria. It could be infected with viruses, right? It could be killed by a number of different factors. So what the mitochondria gets is protection, because it's inside the cell, and a person's whole immune system is protecting the life of this bacteria right here. So it's a nice symbiosis. Both the human cell and the mitochondria get something out of the deal to stay alive. Now, how important is it to have ATP inside your body? Okay, really important. So let's see if we can figure out how important that is. So these mitochondria need... Where's my cursor? They need oxygen to make ATP. If we cut off oxygen to this cell, the mitochondria can't make ATP and that cell is going to die. All right? So for instance, how much ATP does this cell need right here? And one way to think of that is to, let's cut off the oxygen supply to this cell. And different organs in our body need different amounts of oxygen because they have different metabolic requirements. For instance, your bones don't need a lot of ATP because they're not very active. But what about your heart? You think your heart needs a lot of ATP compared to your bones? Yeah, because it never gets a break, right? It's always pumping. Needs a lot of ATP. What about your brain? Does it need ATP? More so than your bones. Yeah, it needs a lot. It's almost one of the most highly metabolic organs in your body is your brain. Even when you're sleeping, your brain is doing what? It's controlling almost everything in your body, and you might even be dreaming. So it's very active even though you're asleep. So it needs ATP. So let's figure out how long, if you're awake, if we cut off oxygen to your brain, when does your brain run out of ATP? How long does it take for your brain to run out of ATP? Okay. Yeah, some people are saying minutes. That's really close. Okay. I'll modify that a little bit, but actually, if your heart stops and blood doesn't go to your brain, you can only maintain consciousness for 3 seconds. After 3 seconds, your brain runs out of ATP. That's how much your brain needs just to control everything in your body. Okay? All right, another measure of how much ATP your brain needs, right? If you cut off blood supply, mitochondria can't make ATP, what's going to happen to the brain? It's going to stop functioning, but after another period of time, it's actually going to die. So how long does it take for a brain to die when oxygen is cut off from it? And that's the figure that you're talking about. 3 minutes, right? So 3 seconds, a person goes unconscious. 3 minutes, the brain actually dies. And when something dies, what happens? Can it ever come back to life again?
No.
That means, right, that's irreversible. That person is brain dead. Yeah. Okay. There are some interesting circumstances. For instance, if someone, and there's been a couple cases of this, you know, when I was a little kid, I didn't live in Southern California, it was in Illinois, and there the winters were really brutal, really cold, And so all the lakes would freeze over. And so sometimes I'd like to go ice skating on a lake or go fishing or something. And sometimes the lake had this little place in the very center where it was still water, right? So the ice would get thinner and thinner, and sometimes I would kind of go way out onto the lake and walk on the ice so I could look into the water, right? And I would just drive my mother nuts because the ice gets really thin. And what could you do? You could break through the ice right into the lake, right? And then, of course, drown. Well, that happens to people, especially little kids that are exploring around. And when you're underwater, you start to suffocate. You don't have oxygen, but because your body's cold, it suspends a lot of metabolism, and you can survive for really long periods of time. I think there have been people underwater for maybe 30 minutes or even an hour that have been recovered and revived. But that's because their body basically was frozen down because of the frigid water. Okay, so there are some circumstances. And other people can respond or sustain life when they can't breathe for a long period of time, and those are infants, newborn infants. Maybe if they have an umbilical cord wrapped around their neck, their brains can go without oxygen for many, many minutes without any kind of brain damage whatsoever. And we don't really know why that is at this point in time. So there are different kinds of circumstances where people can go for long periods of time without oxygen going through their brain, right, and still recover. But typically, we say consciousness goes away after 3 seconds, and then after 3 minutes, all right, that's really when somebody's brain dies. Yeah. A coma could be due to a brain damage. All right, there's an interesting legal kind of case and political case. A coma is when somebody can't maintain consciousness, right? So maybe parts of their body might function, but they really have no clue what's going on around them and they can't communicate, right? They're really like asleep. But they're really asleep because their brain isn't working. All right, so when somebody stops breathing for a certain period of time, some parts of their brain are going to die after 3 minutes, right? But maybe they get revived like in 3.5 or 4 minutes. Other parts of their brain, especially, we're going to learn about this part. It's called the brainstem, the medulla, which controls a lot of internal functions. It's not as sensitive to brain death as the higher functions of our brain, like consciousness. So those areas that control your heart and your breathing still stay alive. But the part of the brain that you understand your reality and can communicate with the environment, those are the parts that die, that are most susceptible to being cut off. So somebody can be partially brain dead, where they have no idea what's going on around them, but have other parts of their brain still function to maintain their heart and even breathing. Breathing is one of the last things in the brain that actually goes away. Okay.
Is that the order always?
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty, unless there's trauma involved that affects one part of the brain. So you probably remember a case in Florida. I think the woman's name was Terry Schiavo. Does anybody remember a Terry Schiavo case? And nobody really knows why she stopped breathing. But she stopped breathing for longer than 3 minutes, and that damaged most parts of her brain, the part that is used for consciousness. Some people think that she was on a drug overdose. Other people said her husband actually choked her.
Wasn't she in a diet or something like that in the program?
Yeah, there's a lot of conflicting stories, and I'm not sure anybody really knows, because for sure if they could have proved that her husband choked her, then he would have been brought up on murder charges and stuff like that, right? So nobody really knew what was going on, except we have this young woman that is brain dead, and she was placed on life support. And the trouble was that some parts of her family actually wanted her to die. They wanted her off life support, and other family members wanted to keep her on life support basically forever, thinking that maybe she would come back to life, you know, like a normal life. And all the imaging studies after a long period of time show that there was no brain left. There was no structure there left in the brain because it had died because it didn't have oxygen. Right, and the people that wanted to keep her alive just wouldn't pay attention to any of that medical evidence.
Because they said she responded.
Yeah, they responded. And when we get to the brain, I'll talk about what part of the brain that is that responds, but it's not a conscious part of the brain. Okay, so we'll learn about that when we get to that area. All right, so, you might be wondering, I'm talking too much. You might be wondering, well, I can hold my breath for more than 3 seconds and I don't pass out. How come I can hold my breath and I don't pass out? Right? And that's why. there's air in your lungs, but even though you're holding your breath, what is your heart doing? It's still pumping, right? So blood is still going to your brain for a long time, right? You can hold your breath for probably a minute before you pass out, and that's because your heart is still beating. But if your heart stops, it's only 3 seconds when you pass out, right? So that's the difference between that. So that's how important ATP is. What's the organelle inside the cell that makes that ATP for you? That's the mitochondria, right? And it needs oxygen for that to happen. What else do we have inside this cell? We got the endoplasmic reticulum, the Golgi body, mitochondria. See these little filaments right here? These are what we call microtubules. They're the internal skeleton of the cell. They give the cell its shape, and they also act as a little railway system inside the cell. Organelles can attach themselves to a microtubule, and the microtubule can move it around inside the cell. Or it can place organelles at a particular location because of these microtubules. So most trains, how many rails does a usual kind of train have?
Two.
Okay. Do you know of any kind of trains that have just a single rail? Like what? I like that answer. Like at Disneyland, there's a monorail. It's a train. It's a kind of suspended. So think of these tubules right here as being like a little monorail system inside the cell where things can hop a ride from one place to another or can get positioned around. And these microtubules can attach to the cell membrane, and it can pull and push on the cell membrane so it can change the shape of the membrane. Some cells are square. Some cells are flat. Some are really long and narrow. And so we're going to learn the names of those different cells. So cells can take different shape because of these microtubules or the cytoskeleton inside the cell. Okay, and you can see some microtubules inside this projection coming off the cell right here. This is what we call these we call cilia. One is called a cilium. And these microtubules allow these cilia to bend, right? And they all kind of bend in unison. So they sweep over the cell. Cells that have cilia are found in a couple places in our body. One is the trachea. Your trachea is lined with cells with cilia. So they're sweeping all the time. Okay, so which way do you think they're sweeping? Down or sweeping up? Okay, because on those cells, when you breathe in, it traps dust particles, and your lungs are a dead-end space, so if all the dust ended up in your lungs, you couldn't breathe. So these cilia capture dust as it's floating by and sweep it up into your throat. And then when you get that dust particle in some mucus, what do? You just kind of swallow it down and get it out of your lungs, right? And that maintains the health of your lungs. Unless you're who? Unless you're what kind of profession? Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out, right? Okay. Spit, spit, spit. Any baseball players, softball players in here? No? Okay. Good. I didn't offend anybody with that. So that's the job of these cilia. It's for moving stuff around. We call that motility. So the job, the function of cilia is motility. Here's another structure. It has microtubules in it. It's very similar to a cilia or a cilium, but it could be probably 10 times or 20 times as long. This is what we call a flagellum, and there's only one kind of cell in the human body that has a flagellum. And that's a sperm cell. And its job is to bend and whip around, and that's going to propel the cell around through some kind of watery environment. So again, the function of a flagellum is for motility. But it's going to move the cell around as opposed to move stuff over the surface of the cell like what cilia do. You see another specialization on the surface of the cell, these things right here that kind of look like little fingers, these are what we call microvilli. They don't move around, they don't beat, so it's not for motility, but this helps the transport of material from outside the cell to the inside. It's important for absorption of, say, nutrients that the cell needs. Okay, what else? Oh, I see some other ribosomes right here. And the ribosome is for protein synthesis, no matter where it's located, protein synthesis. And I think that's pretty much it for all of the things in the cell except for vesicles I didn't talk about. Here's a little vesicle. These are these little round spherical structures inside the cell. Here's one kind. And here's another kind over here. I don't know if it has a different color, so it's kind of hard to tell maybe what the difference is. But, okay. This thing that looks more like a globe right here or right here. So they're a lot bigger than a ribosome, because a ribosome are just these little dots. All right, this one here is a lysosome, and a lysosome contains digestive enzymes. It can digest proteins down into its building blocks, like amino acids. It can take a big, long sugar molecule and break it down into its little component parts. We call those monosaccharides. So there are digestive enzymes in a lysosome, and those digestive enzymes we call lysozyme. So lysozyme is contained with a lysosome. And so the function of lysosomes is that it's a digestive system inside the cell. I would call a lysosome the intracellular digestive system. Intracellular just means inside the cell. It can digest big molecules down into its building blocks. And that's kind of important because, and a lot of times, maybe when a virus enters the cell, tries to infect the cell, this lysosome can surround the virus, and if the virus gets inside this lysosome, what happens to it? It gets digested. And when it gets digested, then it, of course it can't cause an infection. So that's one way that the cell protects itself with lysosome. Okay, there is another kind of vesicle. Do I have it on this slide? I'm not going to mention it unless I have it. I don't have it on this slide. All right. It's very similar, but it contains detoxification enzymes. It's called a peroxisome. You'll learn about peroxisomes maybe in another class. Okay. The other last organelle that we see on this slide right here is the nucleus, and it's membrane-bound. It holds the genetic material of the cell. All right, so the chromosomes or the DNA is inside the nucleus. The job of the nuclear membrane, sometimes we call that the nuclear envelope, is that it protects the DNA. The DNA contains information on how to build your body, how to put proteins together. All right, so if that information gets lost, all right, then that cell doesn't know what to do anymore, and it dies. So that information, the chromosomes have to be protected from corruption so they don't get broken or damaged or modified in some way, because that would cause the death of the cell right here. So that's the job of the nucleus. It protects the chromosomes or the DNA that's inside the nucleus. All right, so I think that's pretty much everything on your list. So I have a question that kind of pulls a lot of things together. Why is it that our cells have all of these different organelles inside the cell? Why not just have enzymes and everything else just running around in the cytoplasm here just doing their thing? Why do we need all these different structures inside the cell? Okay, because we learned that all these organelles have a different function associated with them, right? And of course you can see that all the organelles have a different structure. Usually if things have a different structure, they have a different function that follows with that particular structure. Okay, so use this model to think about why a cell has organelles. Think of this building right here, the SEM building, and let's just say that the SEM building was a single cell and it didn't have any organelles. If it had no organelles, it means that it doesn't have any rooms inside the building. So let's think of the SEM building with no rooms in it, which means it has what? Just one big room. Now, how functional would the SEM building be? So if you were to walk in at 1 o'clock, you could hear, what, a physiology lecture? You could hear a biology lecture. You would get a couple math lessons and an engineering lesson and a bunch of chemistry. You'd have all these professors talking at the same time, and well, that would be really great because you could graduate in just one semester because you could take 20 classes all at the same time, right, if it was just one room. But would it really work that way? It really wouldn't work that way because the physics discussion would interfere with what we're doing in here, and what we're doing here would interfere with a chemistry lesson. There would be a lot of interference, right? So what do we do to a building? Put a bunch of different rooms in there with specialized functions so that those different functions can all take place at the same time without interference. So organelles do the same thing. It allows a very complicated cell to perform lots of different functions at the same time without what? Without interference with each other. So that's why all those organelles are in there. And that's why we need all those organelles inside our cells. Oh, guess what I got right here? Sign-in sheet. Yeah, pass that around, please. If you're not on that list, you might be registered in the class. I just haven't updated it since the 20th. All right, so if you registered after the 20th, then your name isn't going to be, but sign it anyway so that I know you're here. Okay? Okay. Oh, you're not the last person. All right, so that's the role of all of these organelles right here. Okay? All right, so I got a couple of questions. What is cytoplasm? I think I might have to write this on the board, actually. Cytoplasm is everything that's on the inside of the cell. Everything inside the plasma membrane is cytoplasm. So cytoplasm is made up of two parts. And let's see if I get a darker marker right here. It is partly the fluid that's inside the cell, the fluid part, the liquid part. And that liquid part we call cytosol. All right, that just means the liquid part. But there's also a solid part, and those are the organelles. Right, like mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum. So cytoplasm is all of those things put together. The liquid part plus organelles is cytoplasm. Okay. And nucleoplasm, what would you consider nucleoplasm? That's everything inside the nucleus, including the fluid part and enzymes that make DNA and the chromosomes and everything. That's everything inside the nucleus, right? Okay, and you could think of the things inside the nucleus as being like little organelles, and what's inside the nucleus are chromosomes that are made out of DNA. That's the genetic material that defines who we are, but also how our body functions, both of those things. The nucleolus, let me find a picture, right, and nuclear pores. So let's zoom into, all right, so here's the nucleus, and so there are chromosomes inside the nucleus, and there's usually one dark area inside the nucleus. We call that the nucleolus. That's the active part of the nucleus. That's the part of the chromosomes that are being used by the cell. That's the most active part. And we'll see what that means in just a little bit. And then, can you see that there's little tunnels through the membrane in different locations? Right here and right here. These are what we call nuclear pores. And I can see maybe a little pore here and a little pore there. That's the way that large molecules can enter and leave. So here's the nucleus. Here is a nuclear pore right here. And this slide is kind of nice because I see the cytoskeleton made up of those microtubules that give the cell its shape and act as the monorail system inside the cell. Okay. All right. All right, so let's talk about movement across the plasma membrane. Okay. And let's think back to what is the plasma membrane again? What is the basic molecule that makes up a plasma membrane? Phospholipid, all right? So the key term there is lipid, right? And do lipids mix with water at all? No. Like if you get butter on your clothes, after maybe you drop a piece of toast on your shirt or something, can you just use a wet paper towel to get that butter off? No, it won't come off, right? Oil and water don't mix, all right? So the interior part of that plasma membrane is lipid. All right, did we have a picture anywhere? Oops, sorry. A picture of a... Can I show you that phospholipid one more time? Ah, here. Good picture. So this interior part of the membrane is lipid. So what does that mean for water? Can water go across the membrane right here?
No.
It can't dissolve in this lipid layer. That's right. So water on the outside of the cell is stuck outside, and water on the inside is stuck inside. As a matter of fact, anything that can dissolve in water can't go across the membrane either because of this lipid area right here. So maybe in terms of a cooking analogy, Does anybody ever have any caviar? Probably all the time, you guys, right? So you have like a cracker, right? And if you eat a cracker and you start to eat it, what does it sound like? It goes crunch, 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 because it's what? It's not wet. It's not all saturated with water, right? Well, what about caviar? Caviar's in water, right? So if you put caviar in a cracker, what's going to happen? The water's going to go from the caviar into the cracker and it's going to get mushy. And when you pick up a mushy cracker, it's going to fall all apart, right? So it's a mess. And it doesn't go crunch, crunch, crunch either when you eat it. So in order to have caviar in a cracker, what do we usually do? You take the cracker. Okay, maybe eggs and onion, or maybe a little butter or oil layer. All right, and that little oil layer is a barrier that's going to separate the water that's on top of the cracker with the cracker. So you could put caviar on top of it and then come back a half hour later and eat it, and the cracker is going to go crunch, 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 because that little oil is separating the caviar from the cracker. Kind of handy little technique. Okay. So this phospholipid membrane acts as a barrier. It prevents water-soluble materials from going from outside to inside or vice versa. And that's really important. So what our next discussion is going to be is, how do things move across this membrane right here? Right? We call that membrane transport. All right, so movement across the plasma membrane. All right, so when we start to think about this, there are two general ways things can move across a plasma membrane. They can be a passive process or an active process. All right, a passive process means it doesn't require energy. It's just something that happens automatically. An active process, on the other hand, requires energy. And what's the energy molecule inside your cell? ATP. So an active process requires ATP in order for a molecule to move across the membrane. But let's start with the simplest kind of condition, and that is a passive transport process. We'll start with these first. And we see we've got four kinds of processes right here. Right? In order for something to move passively without energy, okay, it can only move from high concentration to low concentration. So only from a concentrated solution to a less concentrated solution can that particle move. So what's a good way to think about that? I have an analogy. All right. When I was in college, I drove a sports car, a really small little sports car. It was called an MGB. I don't even know if anybody remembers what an MGB is, but it was about as big as this tabletop right here. It was a British car, a little bit bigger, not much bigger, but about it had two seats in it, a little tiny engine. But it was really old and it was falling apart. So a lot of times after school or work, I'd get into the car and I'd turn the key and it would not do anything, or it would just go click, 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 right? So I couldn't start the car. But it was such a small car and it had a stick shift on it that it was pretty easy to start, okay? So I realized that even if the battery was dead or the starter motor wasn't working or who knows why it wouldn't turn over when I turned the key, I learned that I could get the engine started if I did what? I would always park my car on top of a hill, okay? And then I would put it in first gear and put my foot out the door and give it a little kick. And what would the car do even with the engine not working? It would go down the hill. Right, and then as it picked up speed, what would I do? Pop the clutch and turn the engine over, and then I could go home. It was really a wonderful thing. Okay, I couldn't do that today with a big Suburban or Silverado, but with that little car, no problem. So could this car go down the hill all by itself without the engine on, without gasoline? Yeah, no problem. But if the car is down over here at the bottom of a hill, all right, could it go up the hill without the engine on? Obviously not, right? So here is the car high, right? Here's the car low at the bottom of the hill. So to go from high to low, we call that what? A passive mechanism. Doesn't require energy to do that. Okay, that's passive. So things moving across the membrane in terms of concentration can go from high to low. Doesn't require energy. But the opposite way, going from low to high, requires what? Yeah, that's active transport. All right, so passive transport and active transport requires ATP, or in terms of my car, you need gasoline in order for that to happen. Okay. So here are some passive transport mechanisms, meaning that it's always going to go from high concentration to low concentration. Let me see if I have a picture of what that really means. I think I have a picture right here. Yeah. So here is a beaker with some pure water in it. All right. And let me tell you what a solution is first before we look at this. What's a solution? A chemical solution. All right. Not a solution to a problem, because you would just say, money is a solution. Yeah, well, maybe. But that's not what I'm talking about. A solution has two parts to it. Yeah, something melted in something else, right? A solution is something called a solvent. Solvent, that's the liquid part, plus a, it sounds funny when you say it, the solute, S-O-L-U-T-E. This is the solid part of something that you put in the liquid part and then it dissolves into it. So a solution has those two parts to it. And on this slide here, you see a solution, right, before it happens. Here is the solid, which is a sugar cube, and this water right here is what? The solvent. All right, and then eventually this solute right here is going to dissolve into the solvent and become a solution. Okay, and so what happens is, after a long period of time, these solute molecules are going to become evenly distributed in this whole beaker, even though at one point in time it was highly concentrated in this area right here. And this is a process that just happens automatically because molecules have a tendency to move from high concentration to low concentration. And you can see this is low concentration because you can see hardly any solute molecules up here. And down over here you see what? A lot of solute molecules. So another way of thinking about this passive process, this is what we call diffusion. That's the first passive process that we're looking at, right? Diffusion. All right, so diffusion is the movement of molecules from high concentration to low, just passively, all by itself. Another way of thinking about this is if I have a perfume bottle right here, or I don't know, a peppermint schnapps bottle or something that has kind of a strong aroma to it, and I open up that bottle and that chemical evaporates into the air. And does anybody feel a breeze going in the room? Do you see a fan in here blowing anywhere? Not really. The air is kind of stationary. I hear a little something going, but there's not a big wind blowing through the room. Even though there's no wind in the room, the molecule is going to move from here, right? This is a perfume bottle, what's going to happen? First, you're going to smell it, and then you're going to smell it, and then the next row is going to smell it. That molecule is going to move from high concentration to low. Where's low concentration? Well, way in the back of the room. So that molecule is going to move from here all the way to the back of the room by diffusion, and it's not going to require any energy to do that. That's just a nice passive process. That's just a part of how our universe works. And our bodies utilize that principle of diffusion too. And when, for instance, the concentration in the back of the room is the same as in the front, then what happens to the movement of those molecules? It actually stops because the concentration gradient goes away. There is no difference. There is no high or low. As soon as there's uniform concentration of perfume in the room, then that perfume is not going to move around anymore. Okay. All right, so here you can see this solute molecule going from high concentration to low, and eventually what's going to happen, it's going to become evenly distributed. Everywhere in that beaker, it's going to have the same concentration. So that is diffusion. And that can happen in liquids, like in our cells, or even in air. But it can't happen in solids. Things can't diffuse through a solid because everything's glued into position, right? So liquids and gases, diffusion can take place. The next term, okay, is osmosis. And is osmosis a passive process or active process? Okay, it's under passive right here. So it's still a passive process. Osmosis is passive. All right, osmosis is just a special case of diffusion. All right, so there are three things that make osmosis different than regular old diffusion. And these are the three things. The first thing, or there's three criteria that have to be met for something to be osmosis. And osmosis means what? Something moving from high concentration to low because it's under that passive area right here. So the first thing is that it has to be diffusion. That's kind of a loaded term because what does diffusion mean? How does something move by diffusion? By concentration gradient, always from high to low. So that's what. So osmosis has got to be diffusion. All right. But it's only one kind of molecule. There's only one kind of molecule, and we learned a couple over here. It could either be the solute or the solvent, right? In order for it to be osmosis, it can only be this one right here, the solvent molecule. What's the solvent in our bodies? Water, okay? So in us, it's water. So in order for something to be osmosis, the second criteria right here is that the molecule that's diffusing is water. It's the solvent molecule, not the solutes. So if sugar is moving one way or the other, that can't be osmosis. If it's water moving someplace, it could be osmosis for one other criteria. And the last criteria is that water has to move across a membrane, a special kind of membrane. Across a, what we call, semi-permeable membrane. Semi-permeable membrane. That means that that membrane will allow certain molecules to go across it, but not everybody. It's selectively permeable. So some things can go across the membrane and other things can't. And if it obeys these three criteria, then all right, we call it osmosis. So if it's a solute molecule, like what's a solute molecule that you have in your coffee? Some people. Sugar, right? If it's sugar going across a selectively permeable membrane, could that be osmosis? No, because osmosis is only water, which is the solvent molecule, okay? And that's important for biology because do we have a lot of membranes in our body? Oh yeah, all kinds of membranes, right? So osmosis is really important for biology to understand. All right, so let's see what our next slide is right here. Okay, so here is a beaker, and it's got a solution. All right, the water molecules are these blue guys right here. How am I doing? Is that blue? Mm-hmm. Looks blue, okay. And the solute are these red ones right here. All right, and notice that these two parts of this beaker are separated by a membrane, right? And remember, things will want to move from high concentration to low. And over on the B side, I only see water, so water is very concentrated over here in the B, but it's not so concentrated on A because I see other molecules. So which way does water want to go? It wants to go from high to low or from B to A as a result of that, all right? And what else do we see right here? The solute molecule is high over here and it's zero over here, so it's going to want to move in the opposite direction, going from A to B, right? All right, but since this membrane is allowing both molecules to move across, it's not selectively permeable. It really doesn't care. So this is not a really good example. Well, it's not an example of osmosis because it's letting everything go across. All right, and after a long period of time, what's the concentration of water on the A side compared to the B side? It's going to be the same, and the concentration of the solute is going to be the same as well. And when the concentrations are equal, that's when diffusion stops. All right, so now let's see if we got a picture of... okay, osmosis. I'm going to draw it on the board. So for osmosis, You got to have your beaker. You got to have two compartments, A and B right here. Let's see which is a nice, maybe a little bit better. A and B, and there's going to be a membrane. All right, and let's just say there are water molecules in here, and there are solute molecules. So water is W, solute is S's, right? And on this side, we just have water, just W's. So which way are the waters going to want to diffuse? Water can actually go across this membrane. It's permeable. Water is going to move in this direction, right, from high concentration to low. But now let's just say that this is a semi-permeable membrane. Semi-permeable means that water can go across, but not S. So when S tries to go across, it gets rejected. It has to stay over here. Right? And if that solute can't go across this membrane and only water can diffuse, this is what we call osmosis. Okay, and there's something else that might happen. Let's just say that at the beginning of this experiment, the water levels are the same. Right, they're the same height. But if water moves from right to left and the solute can't go from left to right, guess what happens to these levels of the water right here? Well, the water leaves here, that means what? This level has to go down and this level has to go up as a result of that. Right, so, and that's why we're really interested in understanding osmosis in living cells, because guess what happens with osmosis? The shape of the cell can change depending on whether water is moving in or out of the cell based on the concentration of solutes that are surrounding that cell. Okay. So for instance, then that takes us to the way we talk about different solutions right here and how it changes the shape of the cell. Let me see what kind of pictures we got. Oh yeah, okay, so this is a nice one. This is what I drew on the board. Okay, so selectively permeable membrane. These are small water molecules that can move across, but here's a big protein molecule. Right, it can't move across, only the water molecule, so water is going to be drained from side B and goes into side A. All right, I guess I'm going to continue drawing some of this on the board right here. So instead of a flat membrane, let's draw something that looks like a circular membrane. All right, so here's a circular membrane. What would we call this thing? This is a? Okay, that's a cell. Okay, that's just a cell. That's a cell membrane. All right, and the cell membrane is semi-permeable. It means it will let water go back and forth, but not large proteins. So and I'll give you what the concentration of water is inside the cell. All cells have a concentration of 99.1% water and 0.9% salt. So the cells in your body are mostly made out of what? Water. 0.1% is going to be water. The rest are things that's dissolved in the water, like salt and glucose and some proteins and things like that. Okay. And in this particular case, let's put it in a solution inside this beaker, all right, which will have 0.9%, I mean to put a percent right here, salt. So if it's 0.9% salt, how much water is in this beaker right here? It's going to be 100% minus 0.9, which is 99.1% H2O. Okay. Now, what's the difference in concentration of water across this membrane? Where is it higher or lower? Is it higher inside the cell or outside the cell? It looks the same, right? So if the concentration of water is the same, is there going to be any movement of water in or out of the cell? No. Right, so water's not going to move in or out of the cell. The cell is not going to change shape. We call this solution isotonic. Isotonic because the cell is not going to change shape. But let's manipulate now the concentration of salt inside the beaker. All right, so I'm going to erase that definition right there. Here is another beaker, and here is that cell. And every cell has got 0.9% salt. And how much water then? 99.1% water. And in this particular case, let's just put pure distilled water, which is basically 100% water. 100%. H2O. So no solute whatsoever. Maybe I could get some out of that faucet right there. Maybe that's distilled water. Okay, now where is water higher? Is 100% higher concentration or 99.1? 100%. Now, that doesn't seem to me like there's a big difference between 100% and 99.1, but you know what? It's actually a huge difference. Which way is water going to move? High to low, or from outside to inside the cell? Water's going to go inside the cell. What's going to happen to the shape of that cell? It's got to change. It's got to get bigger. As a matter of fact, this concentration difference is so great that the cell is going to swell up, and it's actually going to burst. It's going to blow up. And what happens to the cell when it blows up? It's dead, right? It dies. Yeah, it dies. And you can't ever, like if you blow up a balloon, you can't ever put the balloon back together again, right? So for instance, if somebody has an IV, if they're getting drugs intravenously, we have to be very careful about what the concentration of the water is. It should be isotonic, not to change the shape of those cells. If somebody gets an IV with pure water, all those red blood cells are going to blow up. We call that hemolysis. All right, so hemolysis is when those cells blow up because water is osmosing into the cell. The name of this solution right here is called hypotonic. That's a hypotonic solution. If it's equal to the solution inside the cell, it's isotonic. So a hypotonic solution causes hemolysis, right? There's one other case we got to look at, and then we're done talking about osmosis. All right, let's draw another beaker right here. So here's another beaker. We got a cell. What's the concentration of salt inside the cell? 0.9%, so that means water is 99.1% H2O, and let's put this cell in some ocean water. And so let's just say that an ocean water is what? Has more salt or less salt than what's in this tap right here? It's got a lot more salt, tastes salty, right? So let's just say it's 5% salt, which means how much water? 95%, right? Because then that equals 100, so 95% H2O. And, of course, this is a semi-permeable membrane. Salt can't go across it. Only water can. I maybe forgot to mention that before. The salt, right, when it hits this membrane, has to go back in the cell. Only the water molecule can go across because this is osmosis. And don't forget, osmosis is diffusion, which means what? It goes from high concentration to low, just like my car. So what's higher concentration of water, 99.1 or 95? 99.1 is higher concentration, so water is going to leave the cell, and the cell is going to change shape. It's going to shrivel up, right? When it shrivels up, we call that crenation. Crenation is when a cell shrivels up. And the solution that causes cells to crenate is called hypertonic. A hypertonic solution. All right, so those are the three cases of osmosis that you should be aware of. Isotonic preserves the health of the cells. For instance, if you get an IV, once you blow this cell up, it's irreversibly damaged. It can never come back to life again. Right, so it just blows, it hemolyzes those cells, it just turns it into a bunch of fragments. If a cell is crenated, right, it can actually come back to life. If we take a crenated cell and put it in an isotonic solution, then it's going to swell up just to its perfect shape and then stop swelling up again. Right, so that's not an irreversible change. So hemolysis is irreversible, crenation is not irreversible. And that can happen to people very easily. Like, for instance, if somebody drowns, right, you can tell if somebody drowns in a bathtub or a swimming pool because that's a hypotonic solution. And so when they get all of that water in their lungs, it causes these cells to hemolyze, to blow up. Okay, if somebody drowns in the ocean, guess what happens to all the cells in their lungs, the red blood cells in their lungs? They don't hemolyze. They crenate. They just shrivel up. All right, so it's very easy to tell, to diagnose the cause of death for people that drown in different kinds of water as a result of that. Very easy to tell. Okay. All right, so the one question, remaining question might be, how is it for a test you're going to remember which solution causes what? How are you going to remember that hypotonic causes hemolysis? How are you going to remember hypertonic causes crenation? You could just memorize it. I'm not really good at memorizing things like that. So I like little tricks sometimes. And should I tell you the trick I use? But it's really stupid, and you have to promise you won't tell anybody else. It's okay? Okay. And you might not like this trick, but anyway. Notice that there is an O in hemolysis, and there is an O right here in hypotonic. Okay. And there is an E in hypertonic, and there's an E in crenation. So you know what? If I don't give this lecture for 25 years, I'll remember that. Right? So you'll remember that until at least a week from today when you have it on the test. Right? So a hypotonic solution is going to blow these cells up, hemolysis. A hypertonic or a salty solution is going to cause these cells to shrivel up. And in a hospital, that's really important, right? Because you don't want to be crenating or hemolyzing anybody's cells. So you got to get those solutions mixed just right. So I think is there a picture in your book? Oh, wow, I don't have all the pictures. Okay. There's a picture in your book of what hemolysis looks like and crenation looks like, okay, when a cell is put into those different kinds of solutions. All right, is there anything else before we go today? Okay, I'll talk about facilitated diffusion. Just means that there's a substance that's high concentration outside the cell and low inside, so it wants to go in. It wants to go from high to low, but the membrane is preventing it from going in. So there has to be a special little mechanism inserted into the cell membrane right here that allows the molecule to diffuse in. We call that facilitated diffusion. Okay, and that's because, remember, the internal part of that membrane is very lipid, so if there is a water-soluble molecule, even though it's high on the outside and low on the inside, it can't go in. But if there's a protein that will help carry it in, we call that facilitated diffusion. The last kind of passive transport mechanism is filtration, and you're familiar with filtration because, for instance, that's how you make coffee, for instance, in the morning. That's passive because usually when you make coffee, you pour water on top of the filter, and then gravity just pulls it through the little pores of the filter. You don't have to do anything special to get water moving through that filter. And it carries along other little molecules, but it keeps the big chunks of coffee, all right, on the other side of the membrane. That's filtration. Unless you're maybe French or something, and then what? I think you like to eat those particles too. You don't really filter them out. Right, they like really, really strong coffee. Okay. All right, so next time, guess what? We're going to finish up by talking about active transport mechanisms and a little bit about protein synthesis and cell division, and then we'll answer these questions. So next time you're going to have a quiz on this stuff too, right? Okay. All right, what's an organelle? Name their functions. What's your favorite organelle? Mitochondria, because what does it do? That's the powerhouse of the cell. Yeah.